Today is Friday, October 18th, and we're having Larry Johnson with us to talk about the world and what's going on our planet.
Yeah. And everything's boring.
Boring. Nothing to discuss. Exactly. Larry, let's start with the latest news in the Middle East, the assassination or the death in which Yahya Sinwar was killed. And here is the, let me say, the what the Israeli media is talking about. In the Israeli media, they're talking about Sinwar has already become a legend, a much larger figure than the person himself. And his assassination will not change that for generation to come. And here is the footage, Larry, that we had from the late, it seems that it's his latest moment and in this battle. And they're saying, the Israeli media is saying that the footage we see is not what Hamas, Islamic Jihad in Palestine, or Hezbollah see. They see a man who fought until the last minute, until the last drop of blood, even when he was injured.
And yeah, well, yeah, I mean, look, that
who was Yahya Sinwar?
Well, I wrote about this last night. That was the very point I made, that he died at work, if you will. He wasn't sitting back in some command center telling other people to go out, put their lives at risk, telling other people to take the chance of being killed. He was there putting himself right out on the front line carrying a firearm. Now, I think this also sort of highlights the fact that when Sinwar became a, he was, his looks, his image, he was not a, what I call a photogenic kind of guy, charismatic. You didn't look at him and think of teddy bears and unicorns and happy things. You know, he looked like a mean person. And that's how the West would portray him. By killing him, and then in fact, the Israelis, they've always talked about wanting to kill him, but yesterday they accidentally did. They didn't, realize who they had in the crosshairs. It just underscores that the Hamas organization is not a rigid hierarchy. It's not like a big pyramid with one guy at the top, and you take him out, and boy, the organization's going to go, oh, we're lost. What do we do? This is not like killing Sauron in Lord of the Rings, okay? Hamas is, I think of it more like mercury. So if you've ever had a globule of mercury and you hit it with a hammer, it scatters out in a bunch of different little balls. It's still sort of there, though. And Hamas ain't going away. This simply adds to sort of, as the Israeli media is correct, I think they're correctly reporting it. They've made him into a martyr. He before this, he was probably someone that not everybody in the Hamas and especially the Palestinian community knew. But now they see, hey, man, he was killed on the front line. You never see any. Generally what happens, the world leaders like Bibi Netanyahu, they issue the orders that put people in danger and they get people killed. And they're never there on the front lines. They never get their hands dirty. Yahya Sinwar was getting his hands dirty. And, there's inspiration that comes from that. So, to me, I've never quite understood how critical he was to the Hamas organization. But, I think what you're going to see in the coming days is just what happened with Hezbollah. Instead of the fighting being reduced, it's going to increase and it will intensify. The Israelis really they've created a problem for themselves. If you look at how many Israeli troops, for example, have been killed in southern Lebanon since they killed Nasrallah. It's at a pace that is dramatically higher than what they experienced in Gaza. So Sinmar's death gives him temporary bragging rights, but nothing beyond that, I don't think.
It seems that the Netanyahu administration is so happy, and they're saying that we can bring our hostages back, we can just conquer all of Gaza. Is that? Does it have anything to do with the reality of what we're witnessing in Gaza? Is it going to facilitate their way of conquering Gaza?
No, no. By killing Sinwar and then before that killing Ismail Haniyeh, the chief negotiator for Hamas, Israel is sending the message that there is no negotiation. Okay? And then the death of, let's call it the assassination of Nasrallah, is when he was involved with direct negotiations for a ceasefire and was moved, had agreed to a ceasefire and then gets killed. That, you know, if I'm a Hamas or a Hezbollah fighter, I'd say screw them. We're gonna do our talking with our ammunition. We're gonna do our talking with our mortars. We're gonna do our talking with our bombs. We're gonna do our talking with our anti-tank guided missiles. We'll do talking with rockets, with missiles. We're gonna fight. We're not gonna negotiate. There's nothing left to negotiate about. And because part of the negotiation requires you got to have some trust that the other side's going to do what it says it's going to do. And if you don't have that trust, there is no foundation for negotiations.
Yeah, it seems that Hezbollah is talking about some sort of escalation on their part. They want to attack big on Israel. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned the situation on the battlefield, but what do we know so far of the way that Hezbollah, their strategy, and how they are planning to go after Israelis?
Well, they're not going to come out of their bunkers and defensive positions in southern Lebanon. They're waiting for the Israelis to come to them. They've already carried out at least three different ambushes that I've followed, where they'll wire the entrance to a tunnel or to a house, and then the Israelis enter it, and then all of a sudden it gets blown up on them, or the fighters have hidden themselves and they come out and start shooting. But I think what Hezbollah will do is step up its drone, rocket, missile attack in Israel and extend it into Haifa. They've already carried out some in Haifa. They will, I think, intensify that in Haifa and in Tel Aviv. They may even be coordinating with Iran going forward on this, that they will carry, that once, you know, a series of Iranian attacks start, then Hezbollah will launch its wave, because it will overwhelm Israel's air defense system. That's for certain. Instead of what it means for Israel is you're going to get more Israeli soldiers and civilians killed, probably.
Yeah. And right now, Israelis are talking about that they're going to attack Iran as soon as possible for them. I don't know what would be, when that would be, but here is the map of between Iran and Israel. If they go after, if they want to attack Iran, they have to buy their fighter jets. They have to use Turkey, Iraq, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. We know that Jordan is in their hand. They can use their airspace. But how about Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia?
Well, right now they could fly over, you know, Iraq wouldn't give them permission, but they wouldn't care. Iraq doesn't have, to my knowledge, any significant air defense system capable of shooting down Israeli planes. Have you seen the two classified documents that were leaked yesterday?
Which
documents? About So there are two documents from one's classified top secret, one's classified secret releasable Five Eyes.
I haven't
that,
seen
that are from the National Geographic Intelligence, the NGIA. And let me just see if I can pull it up real quick here. It was what's interesting about these is it lays out in detail the planning underway by Israel. So it looks like they're going to use air launch ballistic missiles, and with those ballistic missiles, they've got at least 20 different aircraft that are involved. Here it is. Let me just see if I can. Can't see that.
If you send it to me, I can share it on the screen.
Yeah, let me do this another way. See if this will do it. The reason this leak is remarkable, and the reason I think it's important, I think that it was deliberately put out there in order to prevent Israel from launching this operation. Because what it does is it identifies the kinds of weapon systems, it identifies how the plane, you know, how they're going to be delivered, you know, from an air launched, you know, so from a fixed wing aircraft. And that gives, you know, if it's published out there on Telegram, you can be sure that the Russians and the Iranians have seen it and are analyzing it. Now, I'm sure if I was them, I would be, my first question would be, okay, is this legit? Or is this just put out to deceive us? So one of the ways to, you know, validate that intelligence is if these documents specifically describe how many, you know, where the bases are, what the if the Russians have, you know, satellite imagery, they can go back and double check their own imagery and say, oh yeah, we saw that too. So that would confirm it. So with that confirmed, they've been in a position right now basically to launch a counter ambush against the Israelis and completely defeat that attack if it comes. So that may be one reason this thing leaked. You know, you always have to look at it. I'm sitting here, I got to figure out how to, I might have to send this to myself. Sorry for the distraction. But,
no problem. You can send it to me in the chat, Larry.
The link. Actually, here what I'll do. I'll send it to you on Telegram. That's what I'll do.
Okay. Let me.
I think. No, that didn't do it. Copy. And then. Chat, private chat. Let it go. All right. Well, I have to send it to you later. This is
okay.
It's turned pretty frustrating, but there are, the appearance of these two documents last night. It first showed up on Calibrated, I believe. It lays out in detail what the Israelis are trying to do. So, you know, I think this means now Iran and Russia knows what they're going to do. And the fact that this now has leaked, it may cause Israel to go, okay, wait a second, our plan is out there. Do we want to move forward with this? They may hesitate. And that may have been the entire purpose behind the leak. You know, it wasn't just to say, oh, let's put it out there. This would be nice to know. No, this is, this may be, you know, the sensitivity of this information is such that it's almost like I would say it was an authorized leak to get it out there, but do it in a way that would not directly show the fingerprints of the Biden administration on it.
Yeah. How about Russia? We've learned that Russia is warning Israel not to attack nuclear facilities.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look, Russia's got at least 1.5 million, and I've heard upwards of 2.5 million Russians living there in Israel, who are also Israeli citizens. Listening to Vladimir Putin earlier today, he is making great efforts, it sounds, to work out a negotiated settlement between Israel and Iran. He does not want to see a war go. One, they've got the BRICS summit coming up next week. And the last thing he wants is to have more, chaos and the possibility of a global nuclear war going on that would disrupt the meeting. So he's taking steps. Within that, the warning from Russia to Israel is something that the Israelis are going to have to pay attention to. They can't ignore it. It's unfortunate that the United States political system is so damn weak and so much beholden to the Israeli lobby that nobody in the Biden administration is going to, slam their hand on the table and say, wait a damn minute, this, you're going to cut this shit out right now. This stops. Nobody's saying that. They'll say, we're going to send you a strongly worded letter in 30 days if you don't let this aid come through. But meanwhile, I have some thoughts. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, we've learned. We knew that they're going to, Iran and Russia are going to sign an agreement, a comprehensive agreement, and in the coming days after BRICS. And there were rumors they were talking about that maybe there are some sort of interruptions, some sort of disagreement between Iran and Russia. They're not going to sign this agreement, this treaty between these two countries. Right now, before coming up to this podcast, we've learned that the Iranian ambassador to Russia is talking about in the after BRICS summit, they're going to sign it. And it seems there is no disagreement right now between Iran and Russia. Mm-hmm. And they have decided to sign this agreement in the last meeting that Pezeshkian had with Putin. Larry, do we know any sort of information about this comprehensive agreement?
No. I think, look, this... This has been in the works, for quite a while, because they've been conducting joint military exercises for 4 or 5 years. So it's not like they had to sit down and say, okay, well, what are we going to do together? They've already gone through many of the steps. So I think the nature of the agreement will be maybe outlining or defining under what circumstances would Russia potentially intervene militarily to assist Iran, to defend Iran? Would it be a mutual defense treaty? There's that possibility. So, it's not, let's put it this way, it's not going to weaken the relationship. It's going to strengthen the relationship. They're going to be more involved with each other, not less involved.
Larry, with these new leaked documents that you've mentioned, it seems that you're talking about some sort of manipulation on the part of the Biden administration to inform Iranians that what Israelis are going to do. And what was the necessity of doing this if they can talk directly with the Netanyahu administration?
Well, because you mean the United States, Biden yeah. administration? Biden. Well, because if they're seen publicly pressuring Israel, that's bad politically. I mean, we've got an election here in less than 3 weeks. And the there's an enormous amount of pressure on from the Jewish community, the Zionist community, Zionist supporters, to to back up the Israelis, no matter what they do. So they don't want to do they don't want to do something in public. Excuse me. That's going to be seen as painting Israel into a box. See, I think I just found a way to get these documents to you. Stand by here.
Okay.
Put them into the chat. I think I can put them into the chat. Yeah, there we go. Did it show up or not?
Oh, it's just the text here. No link. Is that possible to send it over on Telegram?
Hang on for a second. Oh, I see what the problem was. It hadn't downloaded yet. Okay.
I think it's...
Let's try this. Yeah, okay. Let's try it a different way. Try that. Now we're going to try Telegram. And get it to you on that way. There we go. Voila. That worked.
Yeah, finally. Let me put it on the screen for everybody to see. These are, yeah. Let me put it in the...
There's the second one. Yeah, this... The Biden, look, you're absolutely right about the Biden administration's got the power that they could tell Israel, hey, this stops now. We don't have to wait 30 days. The aid's being cut off. You're not getting any more bombs for your planes. We're not sending you any more money. We're going to withdraw our ships. All of our military support there, it's coming out. It's coming away. If you don't stop this now, well, Israel would have to stop. They're not strong enough to stand on their own. but the Biden administration is not going to do that because it would be seen as caving in to Iran, just politically how it would play. And the Democrats already are in trouble, and they're afraid the situation is going to get worse. So. This leak, and look, it's possible this was not done officially by the Biden administration. Yeah, there you go.
These are two. Yeah.
Yeah. So see this first one that you're looking at. It says, "Top secret, no porn." Which, top secret TK talent keyholes. What that means, and can you blow it up a little bit more? Can you enlarge
it? Yeah.
This comes out of, let's call it some SAP, special access programs, without, telling you what all the different letters mean. But notice that it also says, REL, which means releasable to USA and Five Eye, as well as, and then it's, basically this is from overhead imagery, because this document is a production of from basically satellite data, it would appear, and it's saying, hey, the it's laying out the details about Israel's preparations. Yeah, the next, that other document you just clicked on. Yeah, so this is almost, it's like from a PowerPoint slide. Now, this particular slide is, if you look in the upper left-hand corner, is classified secret, but it's part of that overall top secret presentation. And it's, you know, it's laying out what all these indicators are of what they're, you know, right now, based on that slide, it doesn't appear that the activity is at a level yet that's high. So see how it says like long range air launch ballistic missile handling, medium, the next one, then low, air defense, elevated missile and air defenses, it's low, interceptor resupply, low. So they're seeing activity, but not intense activity. So, you know, the threat's there, but it's not at an alarm level yet. So, you know, I think that means that Israel's getting ready to launch, but they're not, U.S. isn't seen as of, you know, 2 days ago. Was not seeing all the activity that would indicate that they're getting ready to launch. But that brings it back. Somebody put this out in order to expose the fact that Iran's getting ready, and or Israel's getting ready to hit Iran, and to also provide Iran with a heads up so that they could be prepared to defeat it. I mean, this leak is designed to derail the attack. Which, you know, if I would hope that's the case, because if they don't derail it, if Israel insists on going forward with that attack, and with U.S. troops now on the ground in Israel, it is certain that Iran will retaliate against Israel. And when they retaliate, there's a possibility you can get U.S. troops killed. And depending upon the nature of the strike, if they hit military facilities, and it's perceived that the United States was helping and enable that strike against Iranian military facilities, then Iran's going to hit U.S. military facilities there in the region, and so at that point we're going to have a war, and so I think that's, you know, that can be one of the motives behind this leak.
And do you think that we're going to see a combination of assassination maybe in Iran together with fighter jets and missiles? Or
I don't think there's going to be the assassinations in Iran further.
Maybe cyber attack?
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's, they do that every day. I mean, look, the Israelis and Iranians have been going back and forth with the cyber attacks since the Stuxnet virus. You know, was that 10 years ago, 12 years ago? That's not necessarily going to kill anybody outright. But if Israel... Let me put it this way. If Israel decided to go conduct another assassination inside Iran, yeah, then Iran's not going to hold back. And I think from Israel's standpoint, they want to try to stay in control best that they can of the process. That's very important. What's interesting, as I was reading the State Department Bureau of Counterterrorism, the last report for terrorism came out for 2022. They still haven't released a report. Here we are almost to 2024, and they still haven't released a report for 2023. But while describing Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism, they refer to the activities of the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the MEK, as a national liberation group. Friggin' terrorists. And they've been carrying out attacks in Iran. And so why I'm bringing that up is any further attacks, Iran has really suffered quite a number of terrorist attacks over the last 10 years from the West, and has really not retaliated for it. Now, I know many at the Pentagon and the U.S. military were very angry with Iran because of the support it's provided to Shia fighters in Iraq during the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And they saw that as acts of terrorism. Well, you know, they're killing military. You're wearing a uniform, you're carrying a gun. That's sort of what you signed up for, to realize that you could be a target. You're a legitimate target of war. My point is, they're legitimate targets of war. They're not some peacekeeper. They're actually an invader, as far as many of the Iraqi Shia were concerned, and the Iranians. So, but we classify that as terrorism, and then gloss over the fact that we've been backing an actual terrorist group that's been going out killing civilians, scientists, and then we wonder, oh, gee, why are those Iranians acting so crazy?
Yeah. And here is, Larry, what Donald Trump said about Iran in one of his latest interviews with Patrick Bet-David.
What's going to happen to Iran with you by the end of your administration?
Iran be very successful. The only thing is they can't have a nuclear weapon.
Are you okay with the same administration and way of governing stays? Or would you like to see it go back to the 70s when Shahs was running it and Iran was one of the top three countries in tourism?
We can't get totally involved in all it. You know, I mean, we can't run ourselves. Let's face it.
Sure.
Patrick, we can't run ourselves.
You put sanctions, the people are going to turn and flip on them. It's not going to be a...
Yeah, that's nonsense. Sanction. Look, give me one example, just one, in the last 100 years where economic sanctions have been applied that have produced the desired change and outcome in a country or its policies that we want. Just one example. Cuba, you know, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Russia, China, go down the list. I mean, this sanction madness has got to stop. It just, you know, we think we've got a tool that can be an effective lever, and it's not. But, you know, I think Trump is, you know, sending a good signal there. We're not going to be the world policeman if he's elected.
It seems that in the terms of the economy of the United States, he understands that the way that the countries are getting away from using the U.S. dollars for their trades is so problematic, mm-hmm. in his view. And he wants a better relationship, in my opinion, with Russia, even with Iran, and because he knows that at the end of the day, the enemy is, in his mind, is China. At least the economic enemy in his mind. I'm not talking about wars and nothing. But do you think that he's going to be able to implement what he's saying right now?
No, I doubt it. I'd be hopeful that he could. But the dynamic, the core of the U.S. economy is built on war. And we shouldn't pretend otherwise. That's why we have 750 military bases and deployments around the world. That's why we have a defense budget that's creeping towards $1 trillion a year. We need to have these external enemies so that we can justify spending that $1 trillion. But you know, the money's going into the hands of really a small number of people, and it's not making America wealthy. But any attempt to turn off that war machine is going to be met with howls of outrage. Oh my God, you're surrendering. You're a puppet of Putin. You're a stooge of Xi Jinping. You know, whatever. you know, because what really needs to happen is the United States needs to wake up and say, okay, stop in place. We're gonna change what we're doing. These military bases overseas, we're gonna close 60% of them in the next year. You're all coming back. We're shutting down, coming back. We're not gonna continue that. Number one, we're gonna focus upon defending our own borders, making sure that the borders are safe and that only people who are authorized to be here are here. And but the United States is not going to do that. The only way we would do that is if we were compelled by events, by economic collapse or war, to restructure. That's the only way it's going to happen. So, you know, but Trump, if Trump is in the chair in the White House, he is definitely going to rearrange U.S. priorities, and there will be less incentive to try to go to war with China and Russia. Can't say the same, you know, with Iran. You know, I think the foundation for a negotiation is there. The United States just doesn't want to take it, you know, because we're still mad. We're mad at Iran because they took over our embassy in 79. We've never gotten over it. You know, we're like the guy that's still mad at his ex-wife because she slept with his best friend. You know, and we just can't get over it. We hate her. We hate Iran.
But the way that he's talking about the Iranian nuclear program, he's not capable of destroying the Iranian nuclear program. He has to negotiate with Iranians to put some sort of agreement between Iran and the United States, which means that he's not willing to go to war with Iran. The Biden administration is not willing to do that right now, as you mentioned, with these leaked documents and the way they're trying to.
Well, I wouldn't say the Biden. There's some in the Biden administration are not willing to go to war, but there are some that are. Yeah, I wouldn't. Don't pretend that the Biden administration has said, "Yeah, we don't want to go to war," because they sent U.S. troops to Israel. They've created a tripwire in Israel that would put us at war with Iran. So I think what you're seeing, and leaks like this occur when there's a split, a division of opinion about what the policy is and what they should do.
Because the war with Iran in the Middle East would be the end of Israel, Larry, to be honest. And I don't know how they can save Israel. Yeah. And by a big war, by a major war with Iran.
No, I agree. I agree. This is, you know, what's sad about this, and we've talked about this before. You know, I grew up with the Exodus narrative of the Israel is David, the Arab population is Goliath, the little David, innocent kid, trying to just grow up and live life in peace, and always being attacked by these Arabs and these crazed Muslims. And Israel always, for a while, it could always sort of pretend that it was the good guy, that it was, you know, stood for integrity and peace and human rights and, you know, is fighting injustice. You know, and that narrative still works among some in the United States, particular people in my age group. But what Israel's been doing, particularly over the last 13 months, and, you know, the Palestinians who lived under this for 70 years will say, well, what's new? You know, but the images that are coming out of dead, the mangled bodies of little children, of babies, the film of people burning alive who were not carrying weapons. They weren't engaged with any military activity. They're sleeping, for God's sake, outside a hospital looking for safety. That is, it's creating a stain on Israel as a pariah country. It is, it's akin to what happened to South Africa during the last days of apartheid, and as the world revulsion against the white supremacists who dominated government in South Africa were finally forced out. And I think, frankly, that's where Israel's headed on this now, because they have virtually no support at the United Nations, and you've got an increasing number of countries. I think Bolivia, Venezuela, Colombia, and Nicaragua at least have broken relations with Israel. You know, Israel used to have a lot of friends in Central and South America. No longer. So yeah, I think they're doing enormous damage to themselves that frankly is irreparable. There's no way, you know, if you've, it's a blood stain that they're not going to be able to wash out.
Shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, here is Ben Hodges asking why NATO is not shooting down Russian missiles.
Are we not willing to do that in Ukraine, to at least be actively involved to shoot down missiles, I'm not talking about Russian aircraft, but missiles that are headed towards civilian targets?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a big question about how directly the NATO forces would be involved in the conflict. We've made absolutely clear that we'll defend the territory that's covered by Article 5. You know, we've had these occasional incursions like with the drone in Latvia, some in Romania. That's a matter for NATO to talk about the right way that we protect against that. The decision ultimately of whether and how we'll be more involved in the fighting over Ukraine is a big one. That's for the leaders to take. I think it's a reason that President Biden was hoping to get the UDCG together, not to address just that question, but for all the leaders to look at each other in a room and say, you know, are we really at a pivotal moment in this conflict, and what are the steps that we'll take going forward? So I think it's a provocative single question, but it's part of a wider discussion of how committed we are to Ukraine's victory in this war, and what are all the steps that we have to make to achieve that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let me read you this. This is what I was looking for when he was talking. I think that was this was recorded at the annual Army conference in. It was called AUSA. Yeah. So I've got a friend who's attending there. And this friend wrote just the other day, he said, I found out that the Biden administration has restricted sales of Patriot missiles so they can direct where to send the limited resources. 17 countries have Patriot, and they can't order more missiles. We lost the surge capability, which used to be built into contracts as part of the peace dividend when the wall came down. A surge capability means that we'd have enough in stock in the warehouse inventory that we could send more out. They're saying 17 countries bought this thing. We got no more to give. Okay, think about it. So why aren't we shooting down missiles? Because we don't have any damn systems to shoot the missiles down with. I mean, come on. That's the problem. I mean, Hodges is such a dunderhead. Good Lord. I'm stunned that he was made it to the top of a command, was able to be the European commanders in UCOM. Just staggering. The reason we're not shooting down Russian missiles is because we do not have the capability to do so. Okay? Stop pretending. God, this is... You know, you got young kids where they'll dress up and pretend to be different things, superheroes or whatever, okay? It's this level of childishness that we're seeing out of these people who are supposed to be more experienced and more knowledgeable. Just crazy.
Yeah. And here is what the former CIA director, Gina Haspel,
I know this isn't a decision up to Jim. It's up to really at the higher levels of heads of state. But it seems to me that the answer to the question about allowing Ukrainians to use these long-range missiles to target where the you know where they're coming from inside Russia, why can't it? All these countries, the Germans, the Brits, the Americans, adopt more of a strategic ambiguity, quietly tell Ukrainians, you can do it. We don't need to announce it. They don't need to announce it. They just do it. And we don't need to talk about it because actually, you know, that's, I think there's full support. Otherwise, you know, it's a war of attrition that the Ukrainians are going to lose because they can't defend themselves. They can't defend civilian areas. And this is just targeting military bases or the places where these weapons are coming from.
Yeah. She was director of the CIA. That should tell you everything you need to know about the disaster at that operation. You know, look, Gina started off and as I recall, I mean, she was there about the start about the same time I did back in 1985. And, you know, she wasn't even what you'd call a stellar analyst back then. I mean, for God's sake. Yeah, go ahead. Let's say this let me give you a real story. Because this illustrates the stupidity of what she just said. There was this couple. They had four kids. They lived in a three-bedroom house. The kids were aged 14, 12, 10, and 8. Okay, so the 10-year-old boy was always getting blamed for stuff, and he was, you know, he felt that he was not loved. The 8-year-old girl, she was spoiled rotten. So one time at Easter, her parents bought her a 4-foot-tall Easter bunny, you know, one of those stuffed bunnies, and said, don't tell your brother that we got you this. Now, this is a 4-foot bunny in a 3-bedroom house. Where are you going to hide it? There's no way to hide that. So here's Gina Haspel. Yeah, well, let's just not talk about it in public, but let's give them the wink and the nod and say, go ahead with our missiles that we've given them to shoot into Russia, and hey, the Russians will be cool with that. Are you kidding me? This level of idiocy is why the United States is in trouble. I can't, you know, I appreciate you playing that. I mean, it's stunning to watch. I want you to send me the full link of that video, because where'd you see that? Good Lord. Well,
you hear me?
Yeah,
Joe Biden is in Germany, and he has received Germany's highest award. And here is what he said in his address to me.
I think it's fair to say, although I know I only look like I'm 40 years old, I've seen the wide sweep of history. When I was born, our countries were at war. As a young senator, I visited West Berlin and saw what it meant to live in a divided city, country, and continent. And I forged a bond with Helmut Schmidt, my first relationship of candor and trust with the German chancellor, but thankfully not my last. And then in 1989, like millions of people around the world, I saw 70,000 brave souls gathered in Leipzig, crying out for freedom.
Yeah. Larry, what has he done for Germany that he deserves to receive this award?
Yeah, he's tanked their economy. He blew up their primary source of energy. He's got them embroiled in a war that that's made them a host to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees. Boy, yeah, give him an award for that. I mean, I used to think the Germans were smart, and that, you know, we used to talk about German engineering, the best in the world. What a bunch of knuckleheads. To allow themselves to be humiliated by this guy, and then, you know, to bring him over and give him their top award. Of course, you know, they give Biden this top award, and for what? You know, clearly, what did he do for Germany that's made Germany safer, richer, stronger? Nothing. So this is, this is, I guess, sort of bizarre political theater. That's all it is.
And it's so amazing to see what the president of Germany was talking about, Larry. It's unbelievable the level of intelligence they're having considering the conflict in Ukraine.
When Putin invaded Ukraine, he didn't just go after one country. He attacked the very principles of peace in Europe. Putin thought we would be weak. He thought we would be divided. But the opposite was true. NATO was stronger and more united than ever, and that is in no small part, Mr. President, thanks to your leadership. Mr. President, to have you.
Larry, if you look at Germany, not NATO, Germany, Germany is weak, is divided right now.
Right, right.
He said that we are not in that position. He was talking about NATO. He was not talking about Germany. But I think that would be the case for NATO as well. NATO is not that united.
It doesn't seem
to be united if Donald Trump is. They're going to have a lot of divisions within NATO if Donald Trump wins. Even with Kamala Harris wins, if she wins. And how do you see the situation right now?
Well, look, NATO is a dysfunctional organization. It should have been disbanded back in 1991 and wasn't, because its purpose had ceased to exist. You know, the only reason they continue to expand the membership of NATO is not because it's a great club that everybody wants to join. Hey, let's go be part of NATO. It's that NATO needs the additional troops, because if you go back and look at the troop strength of the NATO members when it was just England, France, Germany, United States and Italy, those are the principal ones back. Go back 20 years ago. Well, actually 25 years, 30 years ago. Look at the size of the military forces then, and then you look at the size now. They've all shrunk. Because the cost, the personnel costs for those have gone way up. So what's one way to maintain your strength? Let's bring in more people. But the problem is you're bringing in other nations, which, you know, are really not military powers at all either. But what you are doing is if you're Russia, you're antagonizing Russia to the point where Russia has asked you repeatedly, hey, stop the expansion. Don't come at our borders, because if you keep coming at our borders, we're going to have to react. And for these NATO cats to pretend we're just minding our own business and that terrible Russian fella is coming after us, we're the ones conducting military exercises on the borders of Russia. We have U.S. Marines and landing craft landing on the shores of the Black Sea. It's in Russian area. And then we expect Russia not to react? I mean, come on. This is just, it's absurd. So, yeah, they're refusing to deal with reality. It's all about they've constructed a narrative. They're going to stick with the narrative, and the narrative's going to kill them.
How about this new rhetoric in Ukraine? They're talking about they have to build their nuclear bombs. And
you're familiar with the English expression, talk is cheap? You know, they might as well talk about, hey, we're gonna harvest some unicorns, and you're gonna have a unicorn rodeo. Everybody gets to ride their favorite purple, pink, yellow, blue, green unicorn. You know, yeah, they have the scientific and engineering skill to do it, but they don't have the industrial facilities to do it because Russia's in the process of destroying those. So to do that is, you know, what people fail to take into account is how extensive Russia's penetration of Ukraine's intelligence and military services. The Russian intelligence on that front is, I think, pretty extensive.
Zelensky is asking for more money, asking the European Union to triple their aid to Ukraine, because he's explaining how dire the situation is right now in Ukraine. And on the other hand, he says that it's necessary to, if it's necessary to call up women to save Europe from war, we will definitely do it. And it seems that they want to sacrifice all of Ukraine, all the people of Ukraine, for something imaginary, something fantastic, something that doesn't exist on the ground for anybody who's considering any sort of reality of what's going on in Ukraine. Is that going to convince Europeans to triple their aid to Ukraine?
Oh, heavens no. You know, this is, they say history may not repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. I think that was attributed to Mark Twain, but this is reminiscent of the last days of Adolf Hitler, where, you know, they were taking young children, you know, 12, 13 years old, equipping them with arms. Older, you know, guys in their 60s, 70s, you know, if they could hold a weapon, a Panzerfaust, anti-tank weapon, they were given that. And Hitler didn't care. He, from his standpoint, he wanted it to be, like Götterdämmerung from a Wagnerian opera. You know, everything's on fire, burning, crashing, collapsing. That's what the part of being a good governor, good leader, is you actually care for the welfare of those that you're responsible for. But when you care only about yourself and give no regard or care for the people, you're a danger. You're a tyrant. And that's, you know, what we're witnessing right now is a pretty dramatic collapse of support for Volodymyr Zelensky. I think he'll be lucky to survive to the end of the year. And, you know, I think he'll be taken out before then. But the Russians, meanwhile, are making significant progress every day, more and more and more. The last casualty figure I saw was upwards of 23,000 dead from the invasion in Kursk. 23,000. It's an enormous number.
As you've mentioned, next week we're going to have the BRICS summit in Kazan. Mm-hmm. And did you see the photo of a BRICS pay card that Pepe Escobar shared on X? And it seems that a new something like credit card, I don't know if it's that it's for BRICS.
Yeah.
Well, it seems that they're going to do a lot of things in this new summit.
Yeah, they're gonna come up with a payment mechanism. I forgot who said this the other day, But, you know, in the immediate aftermath of World War II, we had the what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement. It took name because the conference took place in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Which, why they put it there, I do not know. This place is one of the most isolated places in the United States. Well, that out of that came the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the institutions we knew that created the current international financial system that the United States controls. Well, even though that conference took place in like 1948, it took another 10 years for all the mechanisms and components to be put into place. So what's happening with BRICS is, yes, they're moving rapidly and they're coming up with alternatives to the U.S. dollar. But it's still going to take some time for it to come together. But the critical point is that it is creating an alternative to the dollar as the reserve currency, and that is a direct threat to the power of the United States. And I don't see the United States necessarily letting go of that easily, but we'll see.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Let's hope we survive the weekend so we can see Monday morning.
Exactly.
All right, Neva. Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you so much. Bye.